Boris Pearl is a very rich man.
I have far more money than I need.
He lives in a Manhattan Park Avenue apartment, and he puts his wealth in the low eight figures. So, you know, tens of millions of dollars.
You know, sometimes when I've been traveling, instead of even going first class in regular airplanes, I like just chartered planes to bring just me wherever I want to go.
Morris Pearl was once a managing director at BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world. And just as an aside, in December 2021, BlackRock managed a staggering $10 trillion, that's trillion with a T, of other people's money. Now, as for his own money, Pearl had made enough so that he retired at age 54. So these days, as a retiree with no W-2 generating job, he's got very little income, meaning under the U.S. tax code, he pays very little in taxes.
I actually pay a far lower tax rate than, you know, people like working journalists, and I could reduce it even further if I wanted to or needed to.
Oh, Morris. The shade! Okay, but never mind that. We are here to learn. And if Morris Pearl's assets are tied up mostly in stock, then where does he get the cash to live? You know, tip the doorman and stuff. Pretty simple. He borrows. Not like the go to the bank and fill out the paperwork and hope and pray for a reasonably rated loan kind of borrow. Morris Pearl borrows money against the value of his stocks.
I can simply call up my broker, tell the broker I'd like to withdraw some money from my account, and they'll send it to me. And then, yeah, my account will have a debit balance, negative cash, and they'll charge interest on that. But if I have enough value in my stock account, that interest can just pile up and I can withdraw more money every year and never have to sell any stock, never have any income, never have any income tax, and never pay a penny of taxes for the rest of my life. And that's the secret of being rich, is simply not paying taxes. There's nothing hidden, there's nothing secret, there's nothing in obscure offshore islands. You know, there's no high-paid lawyers or accountants involved. We're not breaking any laws, we're not doing anything illegal. It's all right out there in the open.
Here is a system that's working exactly as it was designed to. In fact, it's working so well, back in the spring of 2020, when more than 20 million Americans lost their jobs in just 2 months due to the pandemic, Morris Pearl says for him, it basically started raining money.
Right after the coronavirus lockdown started, just over 2 years ago, I borrowed significant amount of money to invest after the crash in 2020. And then following that, from, you know, the spring of 2020 until late 2021 was, you know, the best years the stock market's ever had. And I made a huge amount of money in those years, still not paying any taxes because I didn't sell the investments. But I'm more wealthy now than I was before the pandemic started by a significant amount.
Now, On Point listeners, this may be my favorite bit of sound we have played so far this year, because Morris, and I, honestly, I'm really grateful to him for this. Morris is just so clear about it. I love this. So, guys, can we do this? Let's play it again.
Right after the coronavirus lockdown started, just over 2 years ago, I borrowed significant amount of money to invest after the crash in 2020. And then following that, from, you know, the spring of 2020 until late 2021 was, you know, the best years the stock market's ever had. And I made a huge amount of money in those years, still not paying any taxes because I didn't sell the investments. But I'm more wealthy now than I was before the pandemic started by a significant amount. When my stock goes up, that's money I can spend. That's money I can give to my kids. That's money I can do anything with, as long as I don't actually sell the stock, I don't actually pay any taxes. So by any normal definition of have, I have lots of money, except by the Internal Revenue definition of have, I don't have any money. And that's why I don't have to pay any taxes, or much taxes anyway.
Morris Pearl is so frank about his fortunes because he's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of wealthy Americans who actually want to change the system so they have to pay more taxes. In fact, Pearl supports a recent idea tucked into the Biden administration's budget proposal. It would tax the unrealized gains of the wealthiest Americans, that increased value Morris talks about, that he can borrow against to make even more money, which is now basically low tax or tax-free. So remember, though, Morris Pearls is a tens of millions of dollars kind of guy, so he wouldn't even fall under the Biden proposal. He's not rich enough. In the great game of American wealth generation, Morris Pearl is just on the 10-yard line. And President Biden is aiming for the Americans celebrating in the end zone. Folks with more than $100 million in assets. That's the top 1/100th of 1% of this country. Or some 20,000 households out of more than 100 million households in the United States. But to be honest, Biden's idea is pretty much dead in the water already. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has said, quote, "You can't tax something that's not earned." Nevertheless, we're going to talk about it anyway and why it's likely not to pass, because it's a great window into understanding how money works for some and doesn't work for others right now. So Jesse Eisinger, he's a senior editor and reporter at ProPublica and author of The Secret IRS Files, the trove of never-before-seen records reveal how the wealthiest avoid income tax. And he's with us now. Jesse, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Magna.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, is with us as well. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Magna. Hello, Jesse.
Okay. So, Jesse, you heard Morris Pearl describe how he uses his unrealized gains to gain even more. How common is this amongst the richest of the rich Americans?
It's extraordinarily common for the reasons Morris so articulately laid out. It's simple and legal and obvious. And does not require extraordinarily complex financial maneuvers or even that much risk, and no legal risk either. You borrow against your accumulated assets, mostly stock. And we have seen glimmers of this in securities filings. You don't see this in – now, we have – obtained the tax records, enormous trove of tax records of the wealthiest individuals, the sort of the 1% of the 1%. ProPublica, not just me, who's done the secret IRS files. And we can see their income and their taxes. We can't see their wealth. The government doesn't estimate wealth, and you can't see their how much they're borrowing against it. But you can see glimmers of this in things like securities filings, and you've seen people like Larry Ellison of the Oracle fortune and Elon Musk borrowing billions and billions of dollars to fund their lifestyle. And that is the technique. It's called buy, borrow, die.
Buy, borrow, die. I give American business credit for finding the best ways to summarize things. But the Larry Ellison example in particular, can you tell us specifically what he did? Does this have to do with the Lanai, the island in Hawaii that he bought?
Exactly. I mean, you look under the dictionary for billionaire playboy, and there's a picture of Larry Ellison. Does have that island. He owns a Hawaiian island. He also owns a giant estate that he's modeled after a feudal Japanese sort of mansion, village estate. And he famously has an America's Cup team and rides both yachts and high-powered sailboats. He's got a nice life. What he doesn't do is pay a lot in taxes. And the way he does it is what Morris does it, but Morris is just a piker compared to Larry Ellison, because Larry Ellison is one of the richest people that has ever walked the earth. And so he borrows billions and billions. his accountant at one point about a decade ago, really worried about the huge amount of borrowing and said, you're running at 110 miles into a brick wall. But there was no brick wall because the stock market keeps going up. And so the borrowing was nothing to him. And he continues to be ultra wealthy. We've also seen this with Elon Musk. People are familiar with him, CEO of Tesla. And he has pledged tens of billions of dollars of stock, of Tesla stock, to borrow against that. Mm-hmm. And so, so this is a very common thing from the merely ultra wealthy like Morris to the unfathomably, stratospherically wealthy like Ellison and Musk.
Yeah. So just to be clear, because it is actually quite simple when you get your head around it, right? Like Larry Ellison owns an island. He owns Lanai in Hawaii. And hello, Hawaii Public Radio, by the way. Aloha to you. And he can basically, he like puts up Lanai as collateral, gets a gigantic loan off of that. It's not even, he borrows against it. But because it's not categorized as income, it is not taxed. Correct?
Yes, exactly. So there are two things that we do not tax in this country. One is the appreciated gains in your assets that you haven't realized, you haven't sold, you haven't converted to cash. Economists think of this as income and have for over 100 years, but the IRS does not classify it as income. So what happens is your stock appreciates, Oracle or Tesla or Amazon stock appreciates, and you've got all of this buying power in that appreciated stock. All of this power to donate to your favorite charities, to donate to politicians, but you can borrow against that, and it's tax-free. Unless you sell that stock, and why would you ever do that, it's tax-free. And it's tax-free all the way into death, because there are a couple of ways that there are tax loopholes that you can avoid taxes at death and the estate tax and gift tax.
Well, Jesse Eisinger, senior editor and reporter at ProPublica, a part of the team that reported the secret IRS files. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I definitely want to hear from you on this. And then we'll hear in more detail what President Biden's budget plan proposes regarding the unrealized gains of the ultra wealthy in the United States. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're taking a close look at the Biden administration's proposal to tax the unrealized gains of the wealthiest of the wealthiest Americans. And again, we're admitting fully that politically this idea is probably not going anywhere, but it's worth investigating because we're already actually getting a ton of good questions from listeners on social media wanting to know if it's constitutional. How is it different than paying local property taxes on your house that gets more, that grows in value every year? And I promise we'll get to all of those questions in a moment. But Jack Beatty, you heard before about how the wealthiest Americans use unrealized gains to make even more money. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, first of all, let me make a confession. All my gains have been realized. And let me tell you, it's a sobering realization. Well, Warren Buffett has been similarly candid as our friend Morris. He said, there's been a class warfare going on for the last 20 years, and my class has won. Well, the Biden plan to tax the unrealized gains of the rich is a strike back at that. It's the 99% striking back. And it's defensible on those grounds alone. What's not so defensible is the politics of this, the way Biden is selling it. In his statement, the White House press release, it says they want to use the money gained from this to pay down the deficit. In other words, it's going to be responsible. We're going to use the money responsibly. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Suppose they said we're going to use the gains from taxing, we're going to use the money from taxing the rich more in this and other ways, and we're going to give it back to everybody else in tax cuts. Wouldn't that be a good idea politically? Disraeli coined a phrase, dishing the Whigs, meaning you take the other guy's issue. For him, it was electoral reform, and you use it, you embrace it yourself. For a generation, tax cuts have been the mantra of the Republican Party. Here was a chance for Biden to dish the Republicans, to say, we are going to cut everybody's taxes, and you're not going to have to pay for it. Only the richest will pay for it. That would have the advantage of splitting, or at least in theory splitting, some of the Republican coalition. The Republican coalition, Martin Wolf, the Financial Times has said, is one of Pluto populism. This would split the Plutos from the populists. Hmm. And every Republican senator would have to go on record saying, no, I want to protect the Plutos against the populists. Instead, Biden has sold it as deficit reduction, responsible government. It's as if the Democrats are terminally responsible.
Mm. Well, Jack, stand by here because I want to bring Steve Rosenthal into the conversation. He's a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, practiced tax law for more than a quarter century, and has written recently about this in an article titled Biden's New Taxes for Billionaires. One is hard, one is easy. Steve Rosenthal, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, let's talk about some of the details in the Biden tax plan. And by the way, we'll hear a little bit later, folks, from someone who thinks it's just an unmitigatedly bad idea. So what the administration is proposing, and again, this is in the Biden budget plan, is that this top 100th of 1% of American households, those worth over $100 million, first of all, if they are already paying 20% on their full income, they wouldn't have to pay this unrealized gains tax. But if they're not, then unrealized income would be taxed up to the point where they would owe or pay up the equivalent 20%. And that could be spread out. That first year especially could be spread out over several years. So good idea, Steve? Bad idea?
Well, the idea has its pluses and its minuses. 20%, that would be, if we count as income, unrealized gains. And Jesse's publication, ProPublica, reported last year that the Forbes top 25 households have an effective tax rate of only 3.4%, if we count unrealized gains as income, which we don't do. And so the Biden plan would increase that 3.4% tax to 20%, collect prepayments of taxes that would be due ultimately either on sale of the property or on death. Biden, during the campaign, promised to tax unrealized gains at death. And last year, he proposed to tax unrealized gains at death. That didn't go anywhere. He set a pretty low bar for who would be subject to the tax. This year, he's added a new prepayment regime. The two ought to be viewed as in combination to require early payments on unrealized gains that ultimately will be collected, you know, at death.
Okay. So we have a question here from a listener who says, would this mean the government would force billionaires to sell a certain percentage of their assets each year and tax those realized gains as income, essentially?
Well, the Biden plan would not force the sale of assets. It would calculate how much gain is inherent in those assets and require the billionaires to write a check as a prepayment of taxes that will ultimately be due. Now, we don't have a lot of sympathy for billionaires because they do have a lot of wealth And as Jesse observed, they can borrow against that wealth. And the Biden plan contemplates they will borrow against the wealth or sell some other assets, not necessarily those with the unrealized gains, but sell some other assets to pay the tax.
Well, and also to be clear, we keep saying billionaires, but this would apply to households with $100 million or more. But I'm seeing here that the Biden administration says of that 0.01% of American households, half of them are actually billionaires. The other half are just they're languishing at $100 million or more. Is that right, Steve?
That's right. We ought to refer to this as the 100 millionaire tax. But can I step back for one moment just to focus your audience on the key problem
here?
Yes,
please.
Well, we have an income tax system. We don't have a consumption tax system when you pay for yachts or mansions. We have an income tax system, and we collect taxes generally when you sell an asset. But what Jesse's publication has highlighted that in the last several years, some of our most fabulously wealthy Americans, most successful entrepreneurs, Larry Ellison, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, they founded companies in which they've become fabulously wealthy because the cost of founding these companies in their garage was rather small, and their stakes are worth mega billions of dollars. We don't tax those stock holdings or those stakes until sold. And actually, we have a loophole, the angel of death loophole, that if a billionaire or a 100 millionaire or anyone dies with appreciated assets, the heirs take the assets with what is known as a stepped-up basis. All of that unrealized appreciation, all the potential taxes, vanishes at death. That's a big problem with our income tax system.
Yeah. You know, listeners might hear me laugh a little through this hour. It's not because I'm not taking this seriously. I'm laughing because the system is quite elegant. I mean, it works exactly as it was designed, Steve. I mean, even just the idea that there's a step-up basis upon death, all that wealth simply becomes, like, as you said, it becomes untaxable again. So let me ask you, I'm glad you took this step back for us. Do you think that there is any way to change the philosophy that's driving the American tax code and it being focused at the federal level on income without doing things like trying to chip away at unrealized gain while someone is alive?
Yes. Biden started on the campaign and last year with just tackling the question of vanishing gains, taxes that disappear forever. He was going to tax these unrealized gains, these appreciation of assets, only at death. Biden this year also wants a prepayment regime. In my mind, the prepayment regime adds lots of administrative and legal complexities, and it's really not worth the candle. But the key issue that Biden tackled is the loophole in our income tax code that allows these fortunes to be amassed without ever paying taxes during lifetime. And then when someone exits from life, the assets are passed on without any tax being paid on that appreciation at death. It vanishes. That's just wrong. I think Biden's campaign start and his pledge last year, I think that worked. It ran into a lot of politics, and I could describe those politics later. But I think Biden started with a proposal that was consistent with our income tax system to close a loophole.
Well, Jack, we're going to hear another voice here in a second. But Jack Beattie, I want you to know we're getting a lot of responses from listeners online. For example, George McCarthy says taxing unrealized gains is not new. We already tax the gains for many through the local property tax, which is generally paid on assessed values of home, not their basis value. That tax is incurred by many who are not wealthy, by the way. Point taken, George. It's, in fact, incurred by all homeowners. if their assets are appreciating in their home. But we're talking again about families with $100 million or more in particular. And J.K. Wilson says any tax increase or taking away the wealthiest's money will have negative consequences on business and the economy. Jack, your thoughts on that?
Well, that question about the business and the economy, you know, the London School of Economics in December 2020 published a study looking at 50 years of tax cuts across, I think, 18 OECD countries. What they found was that lower taxes on the wealthy basically had a the effect on the economy, quote, was statistically indistinguishable from zero. In other words, it didn't help the economy. What it did do, of course, was increase inequality. So the argument from, oh, we need to keep the economy viable, therefore we can't tax the rich more. The evidence from 50 years of tax cuts would seem to be, no, that's not so.
Well, let's bring in Alex Hendry into the conversation now. Alex is tax policy director at Americans for Tax Reform and author of 10 Reasons to be Concerned with Biden's 20% Tax on Unrealized Gains. Alex Hendry, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So your first concern, your top concern.
My top concern? Well, I think there's a lot of problems. I think there's problems with complexity, with valuing the assets. I think, you know, there's many assets like stocks, they have a clear valuation at the end of the year. So that might be relatively straightforward, but then there's assets held by these taxpayers that would be impacted, like art, like property, like rare minerals, jewelry, etc., that might be very difficult to value. And so I can see this quickly just becoming a complete back and forth between the IRS and taxpayers, where you really have this subjective valuation. I think there's a lot of complexity behind implementing this tax, which even some Democrat members of Congress, like Ways and Means Chairman Richie Neal, have said that there's a lot of complexities, and he thinks there's easier ways to go after targeting the wealthy if that's what you want to do. So I think the complexity is really one of the biggest problems on my end.
Well, in fact, I'm seeing here that I think it was last year, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said about a wealth tax overall that it would be something that would have very difficult implementation problems. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes here. But beyond sort of the mechanics of how would you track this wealth that the Biden administration proposes to tax, what do you think that the deeper problems are? Because as Steve Rosenthal pointed out, it's a fundamental change to how the federal government views what is taxable in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it is a completely dramatic change. Right now, we tax income. This would not be really taxing income. This would be taxing paper assets that are illiquid. And so the Biden budget contemplates different ways to possibly mitigate or work around those challenges, but then that creates even more complexity. So I think it's really a fundamental rethink of the tax code. And I think it's something that, would really could take us in time into a completely different code. There's many cases in history of taxes being first imposed on a select few. In the 1970s, the alternative minimum tax was imposed to stop something like 100 taxpayers who didn't pay any income tax. And by 2017, it was impacting 5 million taxpayers, at what point Congress had to step in to prevent the tax from hitting 30 million taxpayers. And those are only the people who had to pay it. Many others had to calculate it. So I think there is a real concern decades into the future that if this tax system was implemented, it would expand and be hitting many, many taxpayers.
Steve Rosenthal, what do you think about that? The slippery slope.
Oh, I'm not really concerned about slippery slope arguments here. I think that the fundamental issue is trying to collect taxes on appreciation that goes untaxed during lifetimes and untaxed at death. And Biden starts at $100 million. I don't think there's any particular reason why we have to reach into the grandmas and grandpas and a small amount of their unrealized appreciation, either during life or at death. In fact, Morris Pearl was a piker, at least as he described his eight-figure wealth, compared to the taxpayers that Biden would like to tax. So I think something should be done. Just look around you in terms of the entrepreneurs and the fabulous amounts of wealth that have gone untaxed during their lifetime and will go untaxed at death. That's a qualitatively different problem, and I think we should tackle that problem without worrying about slippery slopes.
Okay. You know what? We're just about 30 seconds off from a break, so I'm going to take us toward that break and let Alex and Jack respond when we come back. We're getting a lot of comments online here. Ray Russell says, just like Biden's other ideas, this is not the brightest. Why would anyone want to discourage people from investing in our corporations? Our businesses are the catalysts for the tax base. Whereas Aaron Palicki responds and says that billionaires would suddenly stop investing in corporations if they have to pay some taxes. That's a common idea, but dumb, she says. Sure, I'd like to make billions of dollars, but I might have to pay some taxes, so I just won't, is something that no one says. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about the Biden administration's proposal to tax unrealized gains of the wealthiest Americans, the top 0.01%. I'm joined by Steve Rosenthal. He's senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is with us as well. And Alex Hendry joins us as well. He's tax policy director at Americans for Tax Reform. Alex, I want to just drive right at one of the other concerns that I see critics of this proposal raising with vigor, and that is it even constitutional? Because some read it as a potential direct tax, which the Constitution forbids. Your thoughts?
And I think if this tax was implemented, it would definitely be challenged, and I think there's a gigantic question mark over whether it is. You know, the Constitution allows collecting taxes on income. But there's a giant question on whether there's a allowance for a tax on assets. It seems some have claimed there are ways you could design this tax, but many others have claimed that, you know, it's a tax on assets, it's not a tax on income, so therefore it would be unconstitutional. So I think certainly if this tax was implemented, there would be significant legal challenges and a lot of uncertainty over that.
And Steve Rosenthal, your thoughts on the constitutional question?
I agree with Alex. I think there are serious questions constitutionally. I think those questions will be raised. The taxes would be challenged. And I fear that our current U.S. Supreme Court, if you brought a case before it and described the tax as a billionaire's tax, I think you start in a pretty deep hole.
So, Alex Hendry, you said something a little earlier, which I thought was rather important, and that is that these unrealized gains, and many people would point to the same thing. I keep talking about Joe Manchin because he's obviously such a critical voice and decision maker in the Senate. You know, he talked about something that may be real on paper but doesn't really exist, of course, until it's cashed out. So you talked about the illiquidity of these assets. But as we've heard throughout the hour, the assets might be illiquid, but they are used to create liquidity for the 100 millionaires or billionaires who have these assets. And the means by which they create that liquidity is taxed very little, if not at all. So it's realized. It's a kind of income, just not in the eyes of the U.S. tax code. I mean, isn't there something fundamentally wrong about that?
Well, I think, first of all, many of the examples being cited of, a billionaire not paying much in taxes, I think, statistically, those are isolated instances. You know, the Congressional Budget Office releases statistics on average taxes paid. And they found the top 1% paid about a 32% average federal tax rate. The middle 20% paid a 14% average federal tax rate. And the bottom 20 paid 1.3%. So we do have a progressive tax system. Secondly, one of the things I would note is that loans are not taxed. So, the way that the I think there would be simpler solutions to addressing this problem that has been cited without completely transforming the tax code.
Mm. Yeah, point taken on the fact that there is something of a progressive tax system in this country. Of course, there are many people who would say it's not progressive enough. But the numbers that you cited from the CBO make sense to me because, I mean, the wealth of the richest Americans is simply that much more. Vastly more than the bottom, 90 or definitely 50% of this country. So it makes perfect sense to me that in terms of the dollar value that they would be paying a lot more. That is a system that's working. So before I have to let you go, though, Alex, you said that there's some other potential solutions here or your sort of preferred ideas. Give me one of them.
I'm not advocating for a solution. I just wanted to point out that debt and loans are not considered taxable income.
Okay, should they be?
I don't know. I think there's a strong case, to be stated that they should not be. I think that's a lengthy question. But I think that's one thing that should be pointed out in this discussion.
Mm. So, Jack Beattie, let me turn back to you here because a little bit earlier, both Steve and Alex raised the question of how complex it would be to implement this, right? Because the IRS would essentially have to have reliable data on the value of these assets that we're talking about, how much gain they've actually, how much they have actually appreciated. I know you had some thoughts on that.
Well, yes. My thoughts are Elizabeth Warren yesterday at a Senate Finance Committee hearing with the commissioner of the IRS. She put that question to him. She said, well, people say a wealth tax or a tax on unrealized gains would be Herculeanly impossible and complicated. Couldn't do it. Couldn't figure it out. And the IRS commissioner came back and said, wait a minute. At death, routinely, we look at large estates and we have the best estimators in the world. They look at art. They look at stocks. They look at mansions. And they calculate the true value of things. And we have great confidence in their skill. And we do it for about 1,000 people a year, I think he said, something like that. And, of course, there are only 700 billionaires, so it shouldn't be that shouldn't tax the tax people unduly. I don't know whether that's how valid that statement is, but he seemed to be agreeing with Elizabeth Warren's premise that the IRS is pretty good at figuring out what things are worth and even sorting through complexity.
Yeah. So, Jack, I'm really glad that you drew our attention to this because this is from the April 7th Senate Finance Committee hearing. And here we actually have that moment that you talked about between Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and the IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig.
So, Commissioner Rettig, what kinds of assets do the IRS investigators examine in these estate tax audits that they're performing every year?
The examiners in that space are known as estate tax attorneys. They're sophisticated examiners. They're among our best. And they estate tax is based on evaluation at a point in time, date of death, or either 6 months after the date of death. And the examiners look to see if the values were appropriate, if the deductions were appropriate, et cetera, in appropriate cases. They may bring in engineers, which are really economists and valuation specialists, and
And say a word about the kind of property that they look at and value.
It's the valuation of the assets and discounts people claim for the assets.
So like,
tend to be most of the issues.
Mansions, ownership of businesses.
Bars, virtual currency.
There you go. There you go. So the IRS has lots of experience valuing assets like mansions and expensive art and private companies, exactly the assets that would be subject to the president's billionaire tax.
Alex Hendry, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, the death tax is pretty unpopular with the American people. I think you look at a lot of polls and fundamentally people don't like the idea of taxing people at death. So I think that that tax system is there's a case to be made to getting rid of that tax system. But I think secondly, I think that speaks to the fact that the wealthy are already taxed. There's already this system in place. So it's not that they're avoiding taxes completely. And third of all, it would just be doubling down on this system. It would be making it even more complex. You know, this system is by no means a easy, streamlined system. And so it would just be doubling down, creating even more complexity by doing it every single year.
You know, I hear you, Alex, when you say that the American people don't like the idea of taxing people at death. So doesn't that behoove us to do a better job of taxing people while they're alive?
I don't think so. I think it's fundamentally an opposition to taxes. I think from the reactions I've seen, there's also a very much a concern with taxing unrealized gains. Now it is a relatively new idea in the mainstream, but I think people fundamentally understand, returning to the comments of Senator Joe Manchin, you're being taxed on things you might not have.
Well, Alex Hendry, tax policy director at Americans for Tax Reform. He's recently written an article titled 10 Reasons to be Concerned with Biden's 20% tax on unrealized gains. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
So Jack and Steve Rosenthal, we're now settling into what I feel is, in fact, the most compelling part of this conversation, and that is the moral arguments, the political and moral arguments for some kind of change in the American tax code. I mean, Alex Hendry said there, without doubt, he believes that the American people don't really like the idea of taxes at all. Maybe it's, I don't actually think that that's a universal opinion in this country, but there is something about who and how we tax that continuously meets a wall of resistance in Congress, Steve. So can you tell me about what you think about that, and whether Biden's proposal, again, futile as it may be, is trying to change attitudes about what taxation should mean in this country?
So look, Joe Manchin's concern that you can't be taxed on things you don't have, that you might only have on paper, I think that ends with death. Because as they say, you can't take it with you. And if we're not going to collect unrealized taxes on unrealized gains during lifetimes, we at least ought to collect at the very end when assets are transferred to heirs. And I think the American public would go for that. Stepping back, the big loophole here is these vast fortunes are amassed without ever paying any income tax during lifetimes and none at death. Mm-hmm. I think at some level, the buy, borrow, die is misleading. I don't think there's that much borrowing going on. I think mainly we have mega, mega billionaires who've amassed immense amounts of wealth that they passed on to future heirs and create dynasties, which is bad for us as a social matter.
Okay, so let me just jump in here, because this is exactly what I wanted to talk about. The way the system is structured, okay, forget the borrowing against unrealized gains, although I just love the crazy elegance of that. As from generation to generation, as that wealth is handed down and oftentimes barely taxed, we have the upward accretion of wealth in this country, we have, if there is no way for there to be some redistribution through taxation, we have the formation of a pretty concrete aristocracy. I mean, is that the direction that we are headed in or already there, Steve?
I think so.
So then, I mean, what I don't understand is what the moral argument in favor, I guess I'm trying to understand the moral argument in favor of the creation of an aristocracy, because I can think of the moral argument in the United States as an ostensible democracy in opposition to that. Jackie, help me understand this.
Well, yes. When Tocqueville came over here, what struck him coming from an aristocracy was the equality of condition among Americans. Americans expected that there shouldn't be, and there it didn't appear to him to be, vast disparities in wealth. Of course, slavery accepted. An aristocracy is kind of against the American ethos and grain, and the idea that somehow it's unpopular to tax the rich. Well, there's a Fox poll from year and a half ago. A majority of Republicans are in favor of raising taxes on those earning $10 million or more. Biden only wants to do it $100 million. So there seems to be a change in the country. It's as if people are realizing what you're saying, Magna, that we are in process of forming an aristocracy, that when 700 people have twice the wealth of the half of the American population, when according to Oxfam, the world's 22 richest men have more wealth than all the women in Africa, I think people are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not going to carry us to America. This is carrying us toward the old regime. This is something that seems anathema to our expectation of a rough equality in manner and condition.
Hmm. So, Steve Rosenthal, we've got about a minute left here. I've heard you repeatedly say that maybe Biden's proposal right now, it's got some problems, and you would instead, again, if I heard you correctly, would focus on that moment of death, right? When the assets either are permanently separated or out of the reach of the federal government, or if the federal government could do something else. I mean, so specifically, would you like close that angel of death loophole? Would you not allow that stepped up basis when families, you know, inherit the wealth from their relatives who had died? What would you do?
The approach I would take is start where Biden was on his campaign, tax those unrealized gains at death, tax them. But I've told the administration that we could go a little further. We should tax them at ordinary rates, say 37%. And if someone sells their stock or their assets earlier during lifetime, we tax them at the lower capital gains rates of 20%. Today, there's a strong incentive for the mega wealthy to hold their assets to death to allow the stepped up basis. I'd like to turn that incentive on its head so that billionaires who hold their assets until death pay a higher tax rate than if they sell their assets during life. That's my favorite approach.
Do you think is that idea sparkling anywhere? Is anyone talking about that on Capitol Hill that you know of?
I've spoken with Capitol Hill staffers about this idea, and I'm doing some research and writing on that right now. But the fun, just stepping back one more time, there's a big loophole that Jesse's publication highlighted last year.
We just got a couple
and
seconds.
And I think it's necessary for us to address that loophole, both as a matter of equity and as a matter of social cohesion. And so let's find ways to address it as easily as possible. That's what I'm looking for.
Well, Steve Rosenthal, senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jack Beattie, On Points News Analyst, fully realized. Thanks so much, Jack.
Thank you, Magna.
This is On Point.